Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, South Florida continues to have the highest rates of new HIV diagnoses in the country, according to a new report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Miami had a new HIV rate nearly four times the national average, 54 new diagnoses of the virus for every 100,000 people. Two other South Florida cities made it into the top 10 list for new case rates, Fort Lauderdale and West Palm Beach. In terms of demographics, Latino men have among the highest rates of HIV infection. Stephen Fallon is the executive director of Latino Salud, an organization he founded in 2008 to help Latino men find a safe space to get tested, find support, and educate themselves on the South Florida HIV epidemic. Stephen, it's a pleasure. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me, Louis. I do want to mention co-founded with Rafaeli Narvaez.
Thank you so much for bringing that up. Why does South Florida continue to have the highest rates of new HIV diagnosis in the country? What's unique about us that we're not seeing other cities pass us on this? What, are we making any are we making any moves to improve that?
We are, but you're right. The greater success is nationwide. We're seeing decreases in rates of new HIV. But down here, we have so much HIV already in South Florida that the epidemic is just concentrating.
So at what point, did state and local leaders recognize the extent of the problem down here and they actually started doing something about it?
Part of the problem, Louis, has been that Florida as a state has been underfunded historically. The CDC funding model had been to put the funding where the epidemic had been rather than where it was going. Very much to their credit, they switched that about a half dozen years ago. So we're starting to see some resources come online in Florida, but we're still way under-resourced. It's like having 1,000 buildings on fire and only two fire trucks.
You know, you think about back in the 80s and 90s and, you know, when we were at the height of the HIV epidemic, there was a lot of focus on a public awareness campaign to address this issue in the African-American community, but not so much in the Latino community. And as I mentioned at the beginning, we're seeing those numbers really highest with Latinos. Why?
Well, you hit it right on the head there. So much of this is just about resources. The African-American community still suffers the proportionally highest rates of new HIV, of HIV cases, but not of new HIV, because resources were directed to educate, test, and get the word out in communities. Preachers from the pulpit talking to their flock, everything was done to try to bend that curve. But the Latino community was somewhat ignored, and we're paying for that.
What is it, what's unique when you think about like any public awareness campaign in reaching different communities? How different does that campaign have to sound and look? How is the message changing when you're going from one community to another?
Yeah, I trust my guys so much. My staff are fantastic. We have three locations, 30 staff. Staff come from 13 different countries. And each country has its own cultural values, its own norms, its own lingo. And my staff know how to talk to people in the language where they're from.
So I want to come back to, you know, how do HIV rates in the Latino community compare to other groups now? Because as we mentioned, as I said just now, that, you know, before it seemed like there was so much focus on the African-American community. How does it break down? How do you break down what's going on right now in South Florida between all the different communities?
Well, for my own agency, we are drowning. Because as you mentioned, to have 54 new cases per 100,000 makes Miami-Dade County number one in the nation. I just saw the data for our year-to-date testing out of my own agency, and we have 49 new infections out of 2,000 tests.
How do you break it down by age?
So we see sort of an inverted bell curve. We see the youth, and we see a surprising increase in the older populations, not so much in the middle right now.
I come back to this idea, is there something unique beyond not putting enough resources? Is there something unique about South Florida?
We're a community of immigrants. So things that you and I take for granted, we all had safer sex education in our high school, maybe even our middle school. We watched TV shows with HIV positive characters. As I mentioned before, we may have even heard our preacher speaking from the pulpit about HIV. Many of our residents here in South Florida came from countries where there was none of that. And they also tend to be lower in health literacy. Now, health literacy isn't only based upon reading literacy, but they do track alike. So there's already a language barrier as well. And somebody coming from a country where maybe there was no medical support budget, they're not even used to knowing where to go look for whether prevention services or treatment.
Tell us about how Latino Salud started. How did this begin? Because I think I remember, my understanding is that you were part of another group that was working on this and they just disappeared.
That's right. Well, I had a consultancy and I set up programs around the nation. I've worked in 42 states. One of them happened to be here, and a program that was running very well, that agency decided they didn't want to work in HIV anymore. So Latino Salud was founded initially to fill a gap. That was to replace a program that was dropped by another agency. And we continued filling gaps. We filled a gap when another agency went out of business in Miami Beach. And we filled a gap where no service providers were available in the Central Southwest Corridor in Kendall.
Is the focus of Latino Salud specifically toward gay men, the gay Latino population here in South Florida?
So our mission statement focuses on gay Latinos and on anyone living with HIV, and on anyone who identifies as transgender. But of course, we also provide testing for just anybody who walks in the door.
And you have three very strategic locations, Wilton Manors, Miami Beach, and Kendall. Why those specific areas?
Well, Miami Beach and Wilton are sort of the gay ghettos, and HIV is far higher in the gay community than it is in the heterosexual community. So we want to have convenient services. That's also why we're open non-traditional hours. We don't 9 to 5 it. We're 11 to 9 p.m. walk-in service. When we opened up in Miami Beach and learned more about this county, we also found about the bedroom communities in the Central Corridor where there were no providers available. So we chose to open up there as well.
Again, I'm talking with Dr. Stephen Fallon, Executive Director of Latino Salud, the nonprofit organization operating out of Kendall, Miami Beach, and Wilton Manors, providing services and education for Latino men with HIV. A new report from the CDC found the rates of HIV infections in Miami still the highest in the country. Dr. Fallon, are there advocates in the gay Latino community that are on those decision-making roles right now?
Well, there's a number of planning groups. My staff serve on these committees, so we try to coordinate resources, not be duplicative, and also be responsive to the current needs. For my own agency, we're very proud of having developed an intervention that we call Diversis Safe. It's a mashup of diversity and safety. And the way we came across that was we surveyed about 300 people and found out what they know about how to stay safe and what they didn't know. And we formatted a short intervention that speaks in their language, their vernacular.
Something interesting you mentioned a moment ago. So we come back to this idea that, you know, you have a lot of immigrants and maybe they weren't taught much on not just health, basic health issues, but especially on the issue of HIV and AIDS. So they come to this country and this is an issue that we've been talking about a lot for decades now. What do you find is the biggest challenge in trying to, one, get past those cultural barriers and then to help them get, you know, understand this is the issue, this is how serious it is, and this is what's available to you? I mean, what do you tend to see and run into?
So there's mindsets that affect the prevention side and the treatment side. On the prevention side, people tend to fall into one of two camps. Either I've been hearing about it forever, it's not my problem, or I'm a gay person, I'm doomed to get it, there's nothing I can do. Sort of a fatalism. So we try to intercede and teach people how to stay safe. On the treatment side, that's where my greatest frustration is. Medicines have improved so greatly that if a person is diagnosed today in a timely manner after their infection, and if they get on treatment and stay on it, they have a life expectancy of nearly a half a century, 45 more years living with HIV for a 30-year-old diagnosed. Yet here in South Florida, gay Latinos live an average of 8 years because they're not getting into care, not staying into care. They came from a country where there was no care, so they don't go looking for it. They think they'll be deported if they enter into care, or they don't understand what the treatment is, so they don't adhere. If they get into care, that doesn't only help them, it helps you and me, because when people are treated successfully, they become non-contagious. Even if a condom is forgotten one night, they can't infect if they're successfully virally suppressed, is what we call it, if we control their virus.
All right, a bunch of things I want to ask about. Now, I mean, I want to cost and a few other things, but come back to the cultural thing just real quickly. Is how often, too, do you run into people, just they're coming from Latin countries, you know, the Caribbean or South America, Central America, and it's not just that they don't know or they haven't been educated, but it's just we don't even talk about this. We won't mention it. We don't, because there's a taboo. There's some stigma that goes to, you know, even mentioning that you might have it.
Right. So you and I all remember the classic story 50 years ago when people would whisper the word cancer as if even saying it out loud meant it was going to fall on your household. Some people who we encounter treat HIV the same way, especially so if they happen to be a gay man. and maybe a religious family. They're not supposed to talk about that, keep it undercover. That means they're not entering into protected, safe relationships. They're doing furtive encounters on the side, which are risky.
And the other thing, too, is you have perhaps some, I'd imagine you have gay men who have never even come out to their families. So even to mention that they have this disease would take have force them to maybe even have to do that, and that's very difficult.
Yeah, it's called the double whammy. And then the flip side of that is some people who immigrate here, it for the first time, they get to be openly gay, and it becomes kind of a candy store. And what we've seen all too often is they arrive usually in a socioeconomically depressed state, and at the same time, they're new to town, they're a fresh face, and so somebody sort of takes them under their wings, promises them a lot, gives them a free place to stay, and it turns out they don't see it this way, but they're actually being exploited. It's actually a deal, a trade for sex that often isn't safe.
You talked about with where medicine is today, that with regular daily treatments, there is a way to suppress HIV. And let's also, by the way, separate, let's understand the difference. Remind us again the difference, HIV and AIDS.
Yes. So HIV stands for human immunodeficiency virus. It's the virus that you catch. Now, the virus chips away at your immune system. And when it's chipped away enough, when we reach a certain level where you're at risk of death, the CDC gives you a new label saying acquired immune deficiency syndrome, meaning you now have an illness that makes you vulnerable. But really, we talk about an HIV continuum, HIV spectrum disease. We don't really worry about that line so much anymore. You have HIV in you. If you don't control it, it's going to populate wildly. It's going to take your immune system down, and then you're going to be vulnerable to everything else that can come at you.
So the medicines that you're talking about suppressing that HIV virus, that virus.
Yes, and it's so exciting because when we talk about the history of HIV treatment, people usually talk about it as 1, 2, 3. We had monotherapy, that is one treatment, then dual therapy when we combine them, then HART, which was triple therapy, highly active antiretroviral therapy, which is 3 drugs at once. So many people assume the reason we're so successful is just because we're adding drugs. But really the biggest change when we went from adding a month or a year to life expectancy, when we added decades, wasn't about 1, 2, 3. It was about availability and tolerability. We got regimens down to one pill once a day with less side effects that people can take, and they're more bioavailable. That means you're not peeing them out. They're getting to do what they're supposed to do in your body.
All right, cost. I mean, what does this medication cost, and is it something that is affordable to a lot of people?
I'm really glad you asked that because that's another one of the issues that we face at Latino Salud. The drug costs are crazy. There's a new one that just came out, and it's $6,000 more expensive than the last one that was the most expensive by $5,000 than the one before. But we have programs in place here in the United States to help people who do not have means to pay for the drugs. In fact, to pay for them entirely if they're earning under 400% of federal poverty level income. So if somebody earning about $47,000 or less, we can get them their medicines for free.
Again, talking with Dr. Stephen Fallon, Executive Director of Latino Salud, and we're talking about, as I mentioned before, is the fact that the HIV, the rate of new HIV infections in Miami, still the highest in the country. And if you've traveled around, by the way, the city, you've probably seen some of the signs in the billboards. If you've gone, for example, you've taken the Metro Mover or Metro Rail, you've also seen some of those signs. This campaign to bring attention and awareness to this issue and to remind people of the fact that this area of the country is still the worst when it comes to this problem. Dr. Fallon, you've seen those signs. You know the campaign. Is it working? How do we even know it's working? I've been seeing it for a long time.
Yeah, we're only indirectly involved with that. That comes directly out of the Department of Health. And most cities in the nation that are most impacted are doing sort of an ETE and the epidemic approach. We have a different name for it here, but they're all trying to focus our resources in the right places to potentially end the epidemic. We are making strides. I go back on a local level to our diverse and safe approach. The old angle used to be, I'm going to wag my finger at you and tell you, wear a condom, wear a condom, wear a condom. But either you're going to do it or you're not. Now, there's actually about 4 or 5 different ways that you can stay safe from HIV, and we let the client pick out which one motivates you most, and we'll explain to you how to do it right.
Wait, 4 or 5 different ways to protect
yourself?
To stay
safe from HIV, yes.
All right, tell me real quickly, what are they?
Real quickly, okay. So if I have a partner who's living with HIV and they're virally suppressed, we call that undetectable or treatment as prevention. They cannot infect me. CDC came online saying this about a year ago. We were ahead of them by about 6 months. A person who is virally suppressed cannot sexually transmit the virus. So their treatment benefits us. So if I have a partner living with HIV, I make sure that they are supported in their care and stay virally suppressed. If I just hate condoms and don't want to wear them, I can also go on a once-a-day anti-HIV pill, a lower level of medication that basically acts as a goalie at a net. And if there is a slip-up some night and HIV is about to get into my body, that PrEP medication kicks it out. One that we don't talk about much here in the U.S., but which many gay men in particular have relied on for decades, we call it test twice, talk, trust. If you don't have HIV going into a relationship, and I know that because I test you twice, and we talk about our expectations, are we going to have a closed or an open relationship? And if we agree to closed, HIV can't infect if it's not there to get into the relationship.
You know what? I know you're just on the outside of this campaign, but I want to know if these campaigns, I think back all the way to the 80s when, you know, this became part of just the conversation in this country on the issue of AIDS. And we didn't know a whole lot back then, but man, it hit the headlines and it was a lot of fear. And so we've had to grow up over the decades understanding this. But do these campaigns really work, or is there something we're missing? Is there something more we need to do?
Well, Lewis, you mentioned it right there. In the 80s, we had no information. So at the peak, the CDC estimates that we were getting 160,000 to 180,000 new infections every year. Grassroots communities came together and delivered very simple messages. Wear a condom. You don't have to worry about kissing, but do make sure you wear a condom. And we brought those infection rates down from 160,000 or 180,000 to an average of 50,000 a year. And then we started experiencing a law of diminishing returns. You educate the people who will act on the information, but some people aren't going to act on it. Now we're in another era where there's, as I just described, multiple different sides to the information, different tiers of information to share. It gets more complex. What you need is a lot of touch time with people, and that's boots on the ground. So a campaign with a slogan, a campaign with high visibility is a great adjunct, but it can't take the place of boots on the ground.
All right, we got a question from one of our listeners who sent in, Luigi Ferrer. He says he's got this question about the value of sex education programs and their heteronormative focus. Are schools doing enough to educate about HIV and gay sex?
Well, 20 years ago, I was doing all the education in the Broward County school system, and it was really a different time. It was before the teaching to the test movement, so the teachers really did pull people out of classes, get assemblies going. We were able to educate a number of people. And the way I personally delivered it was in a sexuality or orientation free way. I gave all the information to everybody, and then you do what you want with it. I'm not really involved with the school board directly anymore, though my staff do testing, and they do. We have a small program that we do for gay and bi groups and allies.
You know, looking ahead, you know, into the next coming years, 5, 10 years, I mean, realistically, do you think we can knock Miami off that list, or we can knock it way down? I know that campaign, again, it's a separate from you guys, is, you know, this campaign which basically says to zero. We were trying to get to zero. But, I mean, what do you think we can do realistically with the funds that are available, the support you may or may not be getting, to really knock that number down, that rate down in the coming years?
I think we can make a difference, but there was some great research done about a dozen years ago by David Holtgrave that showed that we would need to increase the budget for HIV prevention nationwide by about 3 times over. And then we could end this epidemic. What we're doing right now is we're moving pieces of the pie. We're trying to, you know, fight over the pie, but the pie is basically the same size. And the way I always point out to people, our national HIV prevention budget is exactly equal to what America spends on chocolates on Valentine's Day alone each year.
All right, I can't wrap my head around that right just yet. That's you know, let me finish with this. I don't know if this is true, but I'm hearing this from third parties. So I'm just I'm curious if people have become they become comfortable enough that they believe that, yeah, we can handle HIV/AIDS. I mean, I remember going back to the 80s, it was a death sentence, and if you had it, that was the end. And now it's like, well, no, people can live, as you said, people can live a long time. Does that mean people have become complacent, like, I'm not worried about it as much?
It's a fascinating question. What you're talking about is called treatment optimism. When the first advances were made in medicine and people were living longer, there were a bunch of studies done to see if people were so optimistic that they'd just be treated and fine, would there be a drop of preventive behaviors? And we didn't really find that to be the case, though I feel those studies should probably be updated, because it's not just a matter of what is your quantity of life? It's also now that people are realizing it's not as much of a burden in your life. But I will say to anybody listening right now, Latino Salud's message, which is also my message to you, is if you're HIV negative, stay that way because life is simpler. It's less complex. But if you are positive, come see us. Our guys will stick like glue, get you into care, and you'll get the full life you deserve.
Dr. Stephen Fallon, Executive Director of Latino Salud, again, a nonprofit organization operating out of Kendall, Miami Beach, and Wilton Manors, providing services and education for Latino men with HIV. And again, as I mentioned, the CDC reports that they found the rates of HIV infections in Miami still the highest in the country. We'll have a link, by the way, to that website on our Facebook, and we'll share it on Twitter as well, if in case you have any questions. Dr. Fallon, thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Lewis. This was great.